Welcome to the Veteran Experience with author, veteran, and judge Mark Johnson. On this show, we provide a place for veterans to heal and be heard. We share stories of heroism, of struggle, of the endless battle to preserve American liberty. And we explore the toll this takes on our best and our brightest. Today, we're blessed to have Tommy Anderson on today. Tommy is also a man who has explored the toll that combat takes on our best and our brightest. Tommy is a best-selling author, screenwriter, podcaster, movie producer, actor, retired firefighter, and retired master sergeant. So, tell you what, let us get Tommy on the line.
Hello.
Hey, Tommy, is that you?
Yes, it is, Mark.
Okay. Hey, so how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
I'm doing really good. Anytime I can talk to another veteran and talk about veteran things is a good day. I was just giving a little of your background. I'm going to repeat it. You've got a lot of accomplishments, and you're a man who's got his hand in many pots. Is that the term? But author, screenwriter, yes. Podcaster, movie producer, actor, retired firefighter, retired master sergeant. Was that your rank?
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
So before we even start going into your history, what do you, is there one thing you're most proud of in your history? Or is it a combination of many? You've done a lot of stuff.
I'm most proud of my service, both in the military and the fire department.
Yeah.
And that's probably my crowning achievement, or that makes me feel the best about everything.
Yeah. I thought you might say that. I feel the same way with my service. Why don't we talk? Let's talk about a little of your background. You retired at high rank from the Air Force, but what got into you? Why did you decide you wanted to enlist in the United States Air Force?
Well, initially, I went into the United States Army.
Well, that would have been a good choice. That's what was my brain.
Yeah, yes. I was in high school, and I had made this determination. I was such a nerd. I mean, it was my dad had served in World War II, and he was always my inspiration, and he was pretty closed-mouthed about a lot of the stuff that he did, and as he got older, he told me a little bit more, but I was swept up in this John Wayne idea of if you want to grow up and become a man, you go into the military, and in my senior year of high school, I realized I gotta do something, or who knows what I'm going to end up doing. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't certainly be a life of crime, but it would have been something really mundane.
Yes.
And I knew that if I went into the military, it would give me some kind of focus and discipline. And the discipline as in the fact of being on time and as my mother would say, keeping my room clean.
Yes. You know, what you're saying are things that I've been an advocate of bringing the draft back. I know we can't, I think we can't afford it anymore, but, and our volunteer army's great, but there were a lot of good things for a lot of high school kids coming out. The military gave them focus, discipline.
I went in when the draft was still going on. So I was able to get in. They had an enlistment back then, which mirrored the draft. It was 2 years of active duty, 2 years of reserve, and then 2 years of inactive reserve. Uh-huh. And so I went into that because I always figured, you know, if I didn't like it, I've only got 2 years.
Yeah.
And when I got out of active duty, you know, I liked it, but I had at that time, I had wanted to be in law enforcement. And being in the reserve, I still had a little bit of income coming in because it was really hard to get a job back then. Nobody wanted to hire vets during Vietnam.
What year did you initially enlist?
I enlisted in 1970. It was like 2 weeks after high school graduation.
Okay. Okay.
And I was still 17. My mom had a sign for me. She wasn't going to, but my dad was kind of always there to rescue me, just told her that he's going to do it anyway. So you might as well just sign it. And it was like, yes, I am. And so she, it was only like maybe 3 weeks until I turned 18. So she did. And I initially went in, I took the, I don't know if they still call ASVAT test back then or whatever.
I know they call it now, but I'm not sure.
But they looked at your aptitudes and what you'd be best at and all this. And I knew I wanted to do something outside. I did not want to be in an office. And I had, I qualified for the Signal Corps. Well, to kid at 18, I'm thinking Signal Corps, that sounds really boring. But as it was, I went in to become an infantry radio operator. And it was really, really an interesting time for me because I learned, you know, the ins and outs of infantry. And I also learned there's a lot of aspects to an infantry company, not just riflemen. And so, you know, being the RTO, you had to really know what was going on, and you were always at your CO's side. You had to be able to call in grid coordinates. You had to do all kinds of things. And it was a big responsibility.
There's little no room for error in that job.
No, and I had I really got good at it. And back then we had the radios that we carried. They were PCR 75, I think, or 70. Yeah. It's kind of hard to remember. But we used to call them, I think, prick 75s. Just as a And in the bottom of each one of them, there was a Morse code key. That was our backup communications, and that was also the NATO backup communication and our allies' communication. So we had to be proficient in Morse code. And for some reason, I excelled at it. And I took this test that the Army had given us, and then all of a sudden, I get this called into the CO's office, and it's like, what did I do? Because I'm thinking, I don't ever do anything. And they say, well, the test scores came back and you had the highest score on record. And I'm going, wow. I mean, it's really unbelievable. And they said, were you in Morse code? Did all this in the Boy Scouts? And I said, no, I didn't at all. I was in the Cub Scouts, but I never did Morse code. I just took on to it. So they said, we're going to send you on. We want you to go and go to Fort Gordon, Georgia for 4 or 5 months to learn crypto communications and then net operations, because we want you to, you're going to run our, when you get back, you'll run our net.
Oh, that's cool.
It was.
What are you, like 19 right now, or what age?
I wasn't even 19 yet.
You're still 18.
I was still 18. And I turned 19 about halfway through the program at Fort Gordon. And it's a lot of responsibility on a kid.
Yeah.
Because you really have to learn. We had to study a lot. But one of the things that had gotten to me, and probably why I do so much stuff with helping with veterans, all the different things, is while I was going through this, my unit went to Vietnam.
Okay.
And I didn't go with them. And I felt so guilty. Yeah. I felt guilty forever because all my buddies were gone and I didn't go because I was in a stupid school.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to figure out what I was going to do, but then I finally figured that what I need to do is to help the brothers and sisters that actually did go into harm's way. So that was kind of my catalyst into what I do.
Yeah, it's funny, you know. Those I've heard that story from a lot of people. I didn't deploy with my unit for one reason or another, and no matter how many times guys like me can tell you, hey, look, there's no reason to feel guilty. Doesn't help in many ways. It really doesn't.
And then I stayed in the Army for 13 years. I ended up going to OCS, and I had was an E6 and went to OCS and ended up breaking my hand. So I never completed OCS. I got a, I forget what they call it, but it was, I was a medical release without prejudice so I could come back and complete the course.
Okay.
After I healed.
Okay. You've got a lot of Army time. This is good. Tommy, you are.
Yeah. And this was, by now this was in the Guard because I was also a firefighter too at the same time.
Okay.
And so I was offered an opportunity to go to the Air Guard, Air Force, in an E9 slot as a fire chief. And I was weighing it and I thought, wow, this is my career field. You know, it's like a golden opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I turned down going back to OCS and I switched over to the Air Force and I stayed in that. And I actually did a lot in there. We did a number of deployments. We filled in all over the globe basically with, something I wouldn't have the opportunity to do in the Army. And I truly enjoyed it. But again, things that hit when, Desert Shield rolled around and they were calling up units. They came to us and said, well, we need volunteers. And I told my CO, I said, I'll go. And he says, no. He said, senior NCOs and officers cannot deploy. And so I was talking to another friend of mine who was another master sergeant. And I said, we finally get a chance. Yeah. We can go with the guys we train. And they tell us we can't go because we're too valuable.
It's like all the fun is done by the captains and the, you know, the E5s and E6s. That's what I've seen in the Army. It's like after a while, the more and more rank you get, they don't send
you. Yeah, it was more important. It says you train the guys that are going to go. So I did. I ran the training program. I trained guys, got them ready, and did all that. They ended up giving me a meritorious service medal for doing this training program, but that's still,
no.
You know, I'm thankful for it. I'm glad they recognized it, but I wanted to go with my guys.
Yeah, I bet. I know just how that is. Now, Tommy, I'm hearing here kind of badass fields, but public service. I mean, it looks like I'm seeing a lot of public service here, and eventually you made this. You've got an artistic side to you too. I guess that's what I think. It's kind of, you're kind of like the warrior poet.
Yeah, and I do poetry.
I have read some of your poetry. I've been studying you since yesterday. I've read some of your poetry, and like I said, you got these badass fields. You're fighting fires, and you were in as a civilian firefighter, I know, and also in the reserve or the guard.
Yeah.
Military, Army. It's. I find it kind of an interesting combination there for you.
Well, you know, it's not for everybody, but I always felt there was a sense of duty to to my community and to the public at large, and it was just like a sense of service.
Yeah,
and I got great satisfaction helping people. And it's one of the things I liked about the fire department was whenever they call you, it's somebody's darkest day and you're that part to help them through it.
Yeah.
And that's probably the most rewarding part of it all is just to be able to be there for somebody to help them through one of the most difficult times of their lives. Either it's a loss of a loved one, loss of their property or their own injuries, you know?
Well.
So,
now, how, okay, so tell me what was the first, Tommy, I know I sent you my notes, but
yeah.
Author, screenwriter, podcaster, producer, writer, what was the first one of these fields that you went into?
Well, what had happened, and I was injured on a fire call. I was injured pretty seriously. I was in and out of surgeries and rehab for almost 3 years before they decided they were going to retire me. And one of the nurses who was with me in the rehab said, you know, I know you got stories. You should tell them, be creative. And I thought about it. So I picked up photography. So I started working with photography and I was really getting into it. And I came up with at a point, I had met somebody from Riverside County, and I had determined, well, I think I'm going to move to California and I'm going to pursue photography. You know, I really love it.
Okay, you're back in Wisconsin at this
time. I was in Wisconsin.
Okay. Yeah.
And I had, my kids were grown and they were off doing their own thing. So I sold my house. I got rid of all my stuff, and me and my, my two dogs and my motorhome, we packed up and like the Beverly Hillbillies and moved to California. Good. And so come out here. I really didn't know anybody. I knew one friend of mine who worked down in Oceanside PD. And that's the only, I think, pretty much person I knew out here. But it seemed like I fell into a bunch of people that we, and again, veterans or public safety people, and we seemed to gravitate towards one another.
Yeah.
And I started doing the photography, which finally got me into where I was doing the photography for Riverside County. I did photography for the Office of Economic Development.
Okay.
And I did photography for the air shows.
Okay.
And that was like perfect. This is perfect for me. And then I started doing them for Planes of Fame, and then I ended up with helping Palm Springs Air Show, and then I ended up starting Camarillo, and it was like all of a sudden I'm getting this reputation in photography. And so I was really going at that. And in the meantime, then I was writing some articles for I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, as a photographer, were you self-taught or did you take any formal courses?
Oh, no, I took photography in high school and in college. I took photography classes.
Okay.
So that's where I initially learned that. And it was mainly just a hobby. And then as things got going on, my equipment got better and I got better. And everyone always said, you have an eye for photography. So, and I did. But I was writing some articles for American Legion magazine, for the California Legionnaire.
Okay.
And a couple other places, because I would get to go to these things, and I had press credentials now. And so I could go to different things and get into and tell different stories where other people from the Legion weren't there. So I was able to, military stuff, I was able to do some stories. I was in 2015, I was doing the air show at Chino, which I always do. And that was like my number one priority because we were like a family there. I re-injured myself. I had to have emergency surgery in LA. I had a broken back from the fire department. Well, it re-broke and pinched off my spinal cord. So they took me by ambulance over to Ontario, to the Kaiser there. I was in their ER for a little while. They gave me some happy medicine. And then they transferred me up to LA for emergency surgery.
Okay.
And while I was there, I almost died. I was in the OR for a long time. They got me out, and I had a spontaneous pneumothorax, and they had to get a surgeon who came in from UCLA, came in to a trauma surgeon to cut my chest to reinflate my lungs, and he couldn't do it under any anesthetic.
Oh, Lord.
And he said that you're going to hate me. I'm going to be the worst person that you ever met in your life. And from being a former medic, I knew exactly what he was going to do. And I kept thinking, no, 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 no.
You can't give someone painkillers in this situation, I take it.
No. And he says, but the minute I'm in there, the nurse is going to give you a double dose of Demerol.
Okay.
Okay. Well, it seemed like an hour, but it was probably 2 seconds.
Wow.
But he said to me before he did it, he says, you're a hero. He says, you're a veteran and you're a firefighter, and heroes don't die on my watch.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, you ever notice these things you remember from your life? Sometimes one little kind word. That's why it's important to say them.
Well, I remember they called my wife, who was in Norco, to come up there because they didn't know how it was going to go. And so I was worried about her coming, you know, driving through traffic, getting down to the hospital and that, you know, with them saying that this might not go well. Mm, but I got better. I was in the ICU for like 3 or 4 days. And I don't know, do you know Dirk Durkin?
No.
John Durkin?
No.
He's with the California Legion. He lives over in Orange County. He got a hold of me and he said, you know, this is the time you got to start writing books.
Yeah. How old are you right now? How old are you?
I'm 70.
Or how old are you? Oh, that was only about 5-6 years ago.
Yep.
If it 2015, yep. What is it? That's 7 years ago. I started writing in late 50s, so I am.
And I had notes done for books, but I just never completed them. So I thought, you know, you're right. And so that's where I took it from there. I did my first book while I was still recovering from the surgery, Who Moved When. And then I got a good publicist who I worked with, Susan Faris out of San Diego, an amazing woman. She was a major in the Army, but I don't hold that against her.
I deserve that, yes.
And I tell her that once in a while, but love her dearly. She did an amazing job pushing my book. And between her and my other dear friend and writing partner, Susie Schaefer out of, she lives in Menifee, made it a bestseller. And so I had, at that point, somebody from one of the studios saw it and said, you know, this should be a screenplay. And we went out to look for a screenplay writer, which I didn't know how to do. I mean, I didn't know where to go or whatever. And I was a member of the American Legion, the Hollywood Post 43. So I asked somebody up there, and actually one of the one of my really good friends now, Peter Dial, he was a captain in the Coast Guard. He's a director and a screenwriter, taught me how to screenwrite. He said, you're a writer. You know how to tell a story. You just need to learn the format.
Well, you know, I have an MFA, a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing, and I've taken two screenwriting classes, mainly fiction. That is a totally different ball game. I'm impressed.
Totally different.
Yeah, I am totally really different. Impressed that you're switching back and forth. And I'm trying to remember. I'm rusty with screenplay, but screenwriting. But I know sometimes some of the skills you use in, say, writing a novel. Like maybe you don't want to. You want to show things. You don't want to tell them. I think it's the exact opposite in screenwriting. You gotta show them and tell them.
Right. It's a totally opposite. That's probably a good way of doing it. And that's why a lot of studios in the entertainment business don't like authors to be with screenplays, because they can't make that transition. I was fortunate enough to have some great mentors, and I'm also a member of Veterans of Media and Entertainment, which mentors and gives classes in screenwriting, all kinds of things. I took whatever I could, I learned, and it was through them I was able to actually finish the screenplay for it and pitch it to Lionsgate.
I don't know if a lot of people realize. I hope people listening realize what an accomplishment that is. For you to transition from these fields over to this is amazing.
And actually, I was asked, you know, recently, you know, what if I prefer writing books or writing screenplays? And I actually, at this point, I like writing screenplays more because for me, it seems like it's easier to tell the story because basically I'm just creating the characters. I give them life. I put them in a situation, all of the things that go around them, the setting, you know, what they're doing, everything, that's up to the director and the director of photography. I give them their words. I give them their personality. I set the situation, and then you let them create the yeah. imagery. And I learned that quickly when I was first writing Kaboom Wind into a script. And one of my director friends looked at it and he says, you're a great writer, but you are not a director.
Well,
he said, this is for a director. I said, okay, I got you.
Now tell us about Hey Boob Wind. Is that what is that about to our audience?
Well, I was trying to think of, I had been working on the Civil War historical novel for a long time.
I am going to ask you that. I'm a big, after this, I'm a big Civil War buff. So yes, but Boob Wind.
So I was sitting there going, okay, you know, I've had this idea for this this thriller where an enemy combatant would come in and neutralize America's ability to fight by using an electronic pulse weapon to take out all of our electronics, our communications, radar, you know, everything.
Yeah.
You know, computer systems, ATMs.
That's not that's not fanciful either. That is I think a real risk. So yes.
And so I started studying up on it more, you know, and I was looking at things, and then I was started watching, you know, the current things that were going on in the world, because I was laid up. I couldn't get out and get around. So I was watching, you know, North Korea at that time was doing their failed intercontinental ballistic missile fails.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're falling short, you know, and people are making fun of them or whatever. And I thought, in my notes, in my mind, well, what if that was just a facade and they were just doing scientific calculations on different types of tests, and they were actually building this missile or missiles that could reach the United States, and we were poo-pooing it because, you know, they're backward. They have, they live in the dark ages and all this stuff. And then I put it together with the situation that was going on in Iraq and Afghanistan with and at that time the negotiations were going on for Iran to end their nuclear centrifuges and that. So I said, well, what about if some renegade Iranians got together with the North Koreans, created a electronic pulse weapon and launched it at the United States so that a hybrid group of, let's say, a combination of ISIS and Al-Qaeda could then move in and attack America without anyone fighting back because everything's neutralized. And so I just kept going with that, kept creating the story. And then I, then through my work with the air museums and that, my story was about this group of military people and ex-military go back and arm these aircraft and use them to fight back because they're not dependent on the modern avionics and electronic systems that newer aircraft are. And one thing, I don't know if people realize when they see the warbirds and all that flying around at the air shows or that, they're all still fully armed. They're just, they've been safety. And they have to be armed because that's figured into the weights and balances of the aircraft. So they can't remove them because it throws off the avionics for the aircraft.
I did not know that. Yeah, you know, one thing that what I was thinking about as you're mentioning this is there's a saying, and I'm trying to remember who said it, that people sleep peacefully in their beds at night because rough men stand ready to do violence on their behalf. And when I was thinking about when you're talking about this, I don't think a lot of Americans understand all the stuff that's going on out there and a lot of the threats that are getting neutralized, and they don't even hear about it. So when you describe things like this, I'm thinking this is a good book. This is something people need to read.
Well, it took it off to be popular. I mean, yeah. I had, and I also put in the fact, one thing when you write fiction, you know, the world is your playground, basically. Mm-hmm. And I could bring in, I had sleepers within the law enforcement, fire, military, who all, you know, okay, their balloon went up, so they switched sides. And you don't know who's who. And it creates panic. And also, I had in there where, you know, especially with kids, they couldn't get on social media, their phones are dead, so they were panicking because of that. And older people were panicking because they couldn't get money out of the ATMs. So it was all things that I thought of logically.
What happened? Yeah.
What could happen? Yes. And so I was on one interview out in the East Coast, and the gentleman out there, and I can't remember his name, but he had said, has anybody from the government talked to you about this? And I said, why? He says, it seems so plausible. And I said, but I do know, I did know for a fact that the military has been training Air Force pilots in flying World War II aircraft.
That's interesting. Yeah, that would.
Has been going on at Edwards for several years now. So I kind of figured that, you know, this story would be somewhat in some bit of reality. Mm-hmm. Because they wanted to get pilots to get back to knowing what it was like to fly a plane rather than fly by wire. And when I was speaking out, I was speaking about this out at the EAA, which is the Experimental Aviation Fly-In. It's the largest group of aviation in the world in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. They do it every year. In 2018, they invited me out there to speak and to present my book. And, you know, there's some people out there, you know, we're kind of like, yeah, but, you know, there's all this redundancy and all this type of thing. Well, while we were there, they had a severe thunderstorm coming in, and the B-1 bomber that was there had to take off. The excuse that they told everybody there is they had to get it out of the area because they had no way to safety it because of the electronic pulse from the thunderstorms. It could take out its avionics.
Wow.
And so I kind of just went, see?
Oh, yeah, no, that's, yeah. Yeah, no, you're spot on. Hey, tell me about, I'm a big Civil War buff, so I know
this
is...
Me too, me too.
You were 2 million steps that you've written and published, and I think it was based on, you have a family history with that Wisconsin unit, am I right on that?
Yeah, my third great-grandfather was a private in that unit.
You know, let me just do a little quick vent here. I swear I have looked through Ancestry.com until I'm blue in the face, and I can't, I would give anything for a private who fought in the Civil War or the independent war for independence. And I don't have anybody. So already I'm jealous, Tommy, that you've got an ancestor who actually stepped up to the plate and fought. So tell us what you were trying to do there.
Okay. Well, also that I won't tell you at a, my seventh great grandfather was a captain in the Continental Army, so I won't tell you about that.
Oh, yeah. Hello, that's what I want. A captain. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I wish I had that. I know. Seriously, I really do. It seems like most of my relatives evaded service back in the old days. And so.
Well, I had. I just knew about him. I didn't know much about him. I remember. His, maybe it was his daughter. She was old when I was a kid, and we'd always go over to their place when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I knew he was in the Civil War, and he's got his name on this memorial for the 25th Wisconsin. And so I went to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, and I did a deep dive. Amazingly, there was a colonel from the United States Army that retired, and he took it over back in the, probably the late 1900s, not 1900s, the late 90s. And he, he completely digitized all of the records for all the units in Wisconsin. And I could go in there, I could get my grandfather's stuff, my great grandfather's stuff, and I could get his engagements, you know, where they, where their basic training was, and all this. And then, I thought, boy, I don't know that much about him. And I got as little as I could. There was not a lot of records kept around where he lived, but I knew, basically the movements of the unit. I was able to get a copy of the regimental records from the date that they were mustered in until they mustered out. And so I went from that, and I built, I had to build a story. I had talked to, who did I talk to? Jeff Schirar, who had done Gods and Generals, and he took over from his dad. He took over from his dad, who did Gettysburg.
And that book, Gettysburg and Gods and Generals, those are amazing books.
Well, Jeff has done some other amazing military books, and I talked to him actually, and I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, what his concern was is he said, I'm not a historian, I'm a storyteller. So I took a historical event and I created a story that went with it. And he had the same fear that I did. I didn't want to write a history book because especially with the Civil War, the minute you write a history book on the Civil War, you're going to have 5,000 people saying, oh no, this happened at this time, not that time. You know what I mean? Yeah. There are a lot of armchair historians out there in the Civil War.
How'd you pick the name 2 Million Steps?
Well, I went on, I had his, the regimental, basically the path that they followed through the war. And I drove it. I went to all the places where they were at. You know, I met with historians. I took photographs. I did a bunch of stuff. And then I just kind of, thought, oh, geez, I wonder how far they walked. And so I basically ran it through a calculator. And I thought, wow, it's around 2 million. 2 million steps. That sounds like an interesting title.
They didn't have the kind of shoes. That's what I went with. Yeah, they didn't have the kind of shoes we had nowadays either. You had to be tough in those units.
I learned so much from, you know, what they had done in the regimental records and I wanted to try to tell more of the story of the soldiers, what they were living through, using my, my great, great grandfather as a protagonist. And all the different engagements that they were in, to try to more tell a story about what that was like for them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I had there when he was writing home and stuff. Well, there's none of those letters exist anymore. So I had to kind of think of if I was writing home, what I would write.
Yeah.
You know, and I tied it around some actual, you know, different things that had happened. He mustered out as a private. His brother, I think he was in the 18th Wisconsin. He, I think he mustered out finally as a sergeant, but in there, I had to create a hero. So he kind of got a battlefield commission because I wanted to make the story a little more interesting.
I love it.
and so, but what people don't realize, the 25th Wisconsin, when they built it or designed that, there was a plan that we're going to make companies from each county. And that way you'll be with your friends, your relatives, and you'll already have this cohesiveness.
Yeah. That was common in those days. Nowadays it's not.
It was. Yeah. And where they were coming from in Wisconsin on the Mississippi River up against Minnesota, that was considered part of the Wild West back then. And so they called them, they had different nicknames for them of, you know, the Western loggers, Western forest men, stuff like that.
You may have said this, but what county was it again?
It was Vernon County, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And they were anxious to go to fight the South, but they were initially sent to fight the Sioux.
Yeah. That uprising.
Up the uprising in Minnesota. And so they were sent to Minneapolis area. But when they got there, there was no problem. And they found the Native Americans to be really friendly. All they wanted to do is trade stuff. And so they sat around totally bored. And at that time, Grant had taken over at Vicksburg, and he wanted to get more troops down there. But Paducah, Kentucky, yeah, directly across the Ohio River from Illinois and Cairo, Illinois, the Confederates were attacking that. And it was General Forrest Cavalry that put siege on that city. And the fear was among the generals is that if they would go across the river into Illinois, there was a great public sentiment in southern Illinois to go with the South. And they were afraid that if they won at Paducah and they went across into Illinois, that they would have part of Illinois break away and join the South. Mm-hmm. So they were sent to Paducah, or not to Paducah, but to Cairo, and they sat there for a while. And then they were finally sent into Kentucky at Columbus, and they were sent on foot to go up and engage General Forrest in combat up at Paducah, but they didn't quite get there. Mm-hmm. And they were rerouted to go to another town down there where he was raising havoc.
Yeah.
And
he was good.
What I try to tell in the story is that they're going back and forth over the same amount of ground, not doing anything. You know, they had this boredom that they were, they were marching on this. They're supposed to go to war, but then all of a sudden they turned around and sent another place. So in some respects, the army hasn't changed.
No, isn't that the truth? That's what I was thinking. It's like, hurry up and wait and all that. Now, did they actually end up, I thought I read that your great-grandfather fought at Vicksburg?
Yep, they ended up.
That is a real, under Grant, wow. He's a person.
Under Grant, they ended up fighting it at Vicksburg.
Yeah.
They were one of the few units that were allowed to go into Vicksburg to witness the surrender of the troops to General Grant.
Yeah.
But unknown to my grandfather was his brother in the 18th Wisconsin was on the other side of Vicksburg. They didn't even know that they were there.
Wow. They were.
And, but they never hooked up. But after that had happened, they had gotten so much disease and sickness. They lost their commanding officer, died of, what are they? I was going to say distemper, but it's not that.
cholera? No, I don't know.
What do they get from? They're basically bivouacked above their urinal or above their toilets and all that. It was dysentery.
Oh,
yeah, dysentery. Well, anyhow, so they sent them to Louisiana to a rehab, and there was a. They were put under the command of Colonel, why can't I think of his name now? He ended up being the governor of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, they liked him. Everybody liked him because they knew him. He was from their hometown. They would do anything for him. And he was relieved of command, put second in command, and sent down to under the command of their original commanding officer, who was a jerk that no one liked. And so they were sent into Louisiana under the Western Command to rehab and get better over the winter months. And they did. The surgeon for the 25th had requested to their new commander, was their old commander, that they be allowed to go home on furlough for a couple weeks, you know, and it would help them, you know, with their health and mental health and all that. The troops got excited about it, and he said, no, they're not going anywhere. It gave him more to hate him for.
That would be. Hey, Tommy, let
and
me.
So,
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I could keep on going on this.
No, I was going to ask you. Last night I was watching Life After Oblivion. Now, I know you produced this. It's an award-winning film. I was really touched and impressed, and I also couldn't help but notice your cameo role in the film at the airport. At the end, but and it involves a Marine sniper who has a 13, 14-year-old boy in his sights, mm-hmm. and he's thinking, he's relating that kid to his own son back home. And then I think the kid, he steps on an IED, and he just blows up in front of everybody. And then at home, mm-hmm. he's... I thought it was brilliant. I loved it. I said, I remember I used to see those kids when I was in Iraq, and God, they look a lot like our kids. And
they're
just kids. I know there's some guys will sit there and say, oh, yeah, they can have bombs strapped on them. Yes, yes, but 99.9% of them, they're just kids.
Yeah, and that's why I put in the dialogue, because like I said, I wrote it. I put in the dialogue where the spotter says he's got an AK-47, and the protagonist says they all do.
Yeah, that is truth. No, that is truth. I used to, over in Iraq, you'd see, if you were on the road through Baghdad, if you drove about, say, 20 minutes, you'd see several people standing out, men always standing out in front of buildings with AK-47s. You can't just light everybody up. And so, yeah, they all do. That's like having a baseball bat in the U.S.
Exactly. And this was a story, a short story that was originally written by retired Marine Master Sergeant Adam Stone. It was a one-page short story, and I took that to make this movie.
What were you trying to say with this?
Tell me. I was basically trying to say that to give, I wanted to fight against suicide, veteran suicide, and for basically for people to listen when people are asking for help.
That's one thing I didn't mention. This guy was really hurt and talking to his therapist. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. And the thing is, I wanted to impress upon people is that, Hollywood and the media, they like to make vets seem like they're crazy.
Yeah, isn't that
the truth? And they don't realize that the PTSD is not, it's of course with vets, but anybody in public safety has it. Any doctor or nurse has it. You're not violent.
No.
You're emotionally disturbed, and you're more likely to harm yourself than anybody else. And with a rare exception. And I wanted to break through that stigma so that, when people are asking for help, they're asking for help. They're really good people. They just need help through this.
Would you call it an anti-war movie? I'm just curious.
No.
Okay.
No.
It's just, no, it's not more, at all. This is something you're trying to help veterans here. That's what I try to do.
Trying to help veterans. I had when I was asked to write it and I wrote it, I had just a dear friend of mine, Tina, who wrote the song for it, Life After Oblivion. Her son had recently had taken his life.
Military.
And he was
God.
Yeah, he was Army infantry for. Boy, at least 8-9 years. And, I've been on with the fire department. I've been on enough suicides that I know how terrible it is for the family, friends and family wrap their heads around why things happen. And I wanted to, that kind of pushed me more that we got to get the word out because especially when I heard he was like the 27th member of his unit that had taken their lives since he got back. And it's like, that is totally unacceptable realm anywhere.
I agree 100% with you about Hollywood, the media, they portray this like crazy veteran who's got PTSD. One of them, if you remember that movie Coming Home with.
Yes.
Yep. John Voight and Bruce Dern, and I can't remember who. Jane Fonda.
Yep.
That Bruce Dern's character, that's what he played, this nut. And I agree with you. I hate those portrayals because then, I've always said a lot of times with our veterans, they've got PTSD and people say thank you for your service, but then they don't want you around. They won't give you a job because they're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I'm right there with you, brother, on that one. So I appreciate you doing that. I think you gave a really good insight in about, I think it's about 12, 13 minutes, a good insight of what these guys do. Yeah, you know, I happen to think American service men and women are the best people on the planet. But these are compassionate people. And when they have to we send them in to do these horrible things. Mm-hmm. And that's what you get. But so we need to understand that, and we need to help them.
Well, that's so true. And people forget, even my wife has said, when she look at how young those guys are. And I go, I was 17 when I enlisted. Oh, yeah,
they're kids.
You know, your average infantry guy is 18, maybe 19. I do believe it. They want you young because you're invincible.
Yeah. You think you are.
You know what?
Yeah. Yeah.
You think you are. You are. As you get older, then you start to realize more.
You start having a few. Hey, Tommy. Okay. So, you're an actor too. I follow you on Facebook and I see that you've played a Western sheriff.
Yeah, I've done a few things. I have, it was kind of a progression. The screenplay came in, and then a friend of mine is a producer. They had somebody in San Diego who didn't show up for a shoot. She said, "What are you doing this weekend? You want to be in a movie?" So I said, "Yeah." I just, why not? So I took that part.
That's great.
Then after that, I got something else. And then before I know it, I had an agent. And everybody says, "You got that look." And I keep saying, "What's the look?"
Well, yeah, are you called a character actor? You got that big mustache, big handlebar mustache. You do look like you look good.
Yeah.
With a,
I love Westerns. So it was like, you want me to do a Western? Oh yeah, no problem. I'll do a Western. And I had, I was on SEAL team a couple times. Playing a older vet, and I had CSI, not CSI, Criminal Minds. I was on, it just kind of went on. Then I was into a couple movies, and then before you know it, I'm doing other stuff, and it just kind of got that way. And then I got asked, "Do you want to produce?" And I'm going like, what do I for me, I'm all up for learning. If I'm in, I'm in. Mm-hmm. And I want to learn everything that's going on in the set, because I don't like being one of these people that goes in and doesn't know what's going on. Probably my, from being an instant commander, is I like to know what everything is going on.
No, I think that's true of a lot of military leaders. You don't want to be like the guy who's marginalized over in the corner. You want to be in the game.
No, so I did that. And I've heard from a number of people in the business that said, we love having vets that are involved in this because their attention to detail, they're never late, they're always prepared. And I said, that's because of our training. We just automatically fall into that where we don't have to be, chauffeured around to places and that we're there, And it was a progression that got into that. And then when COVID came, I had Haboob Wind was going to Lionsgate was looking at it, but then COVID hit and everybody's budget and everything cut back. And a good friend of mine, Brett Davis, who has a radio show on AM/FM down in San Diego, asked me if I would co-host his radio show a couple times with him, and because we were all shut down up here. So I did, and then he was branching out, and they were starting a podcast network, and it was, "How would you like to have your own show?" And so that's how that happened. It was just kind of a further progression of what I'm doing, just a little different take on it. And he gave me the latitude to create my own format, which is entertainment news. And I like to deal with mainly veterans or public safety people, medical people, who are involved in things other than their career.
Oh yeah, I'm all into military veterans, first responders, medical. Yeah. They're great people. they're all great people. And okay, so now I got to hear about your podcast, and let's give it a plug. People need to watch this. The Real Tommy Unleashed. So I've got it. Tell me how many beers you had before you came up with that name. That's a joke.
I don't drink that much. But
no, that's I'm teasing. But I love the name. You have to, and you have to in that. And I love it.
And we're punching around names, and
you're on a horse, as I recall, aren't you? Riding in on a horse on your thumbnail.
I got these pictures that I took a few years ago here in Norco, and I thought, I wonder how this would look for a poster. And I put lightning bolts in it and stuff, and I go, it's great. That's really great.
Yes, it's great.
I had a podcast called The Take It Back Show with Tommy and Tina. Mm-hmm. And we dealt mainly with people overcoming PTSD. And the station had said that, it's a great subject, but there's a lot of other ones out there. And some people are saying it's a little too depressing because that's all you're talking about all the time. I said, yeah, I understand that. And I said, it needs to be a little more uplifting. We can still touch on that, but we gotta make it more appealing, I guess. So they said, I'd rather you do the show by yourself, and we rename it. And then we came up with this name, and it basically says that I'm unleashed to talk about whatever you guys want to talk about. So when I bring somebody on the show, I said, this is your hour. What do you want to talk about? And we sit there and we're talking, having a cup of coffee, and we're talking back and forth. And my last show, which was really amazing, it was just by fluke that I met Bella Levy, who is an actress, model, and a healthcare professional out in Baltimore. And I met her on a movie set that we were on. And she has a Bella Levy Foundation to fight human trafficking.
Oh, that's good.
And I said, you got to be on my show. So we spent the time talking about her show because she's done celebrity boxing. She's done all this stuff to raise awareness and raise funds for this foundation. And she's a character because I was talking to her and I said, you did celebrity boxing? Because I'm standing next to her and she's like 5 foot nothing.
Yeah.
She's a beauty queen. She's won beauty contests, and so she's, in shape, obviously. Yeah.
Didn't look like she's going to be, dropping somebody in the boxing ring.
No, I just can't. Well, she said, they put me in with this other woman who was obviously had done boxing before. And we talked beforehand, and she said, they had this agreement. She says, whatever you do, don't hit me in the face. My face is my money. Is what she told her.
Yeah.
And so the other girl says, okay. She says, what does that bitch do? The minute the bell rings, she hits me in the face. And then I said, game on. Oh, I wish I would have watched that.
Yes. Hey, Tommy, you're obviously not a guy who believes in, at least in retirement, like a sedate retirement. And, tell me, for some of our vets out there, what are some lessons you think you've learned about just through your life, doing a wide variety of things?
Our best days are ahead of us. One of the worst times in my life was when I had to leave the fire department because I lived and breathed it. And it was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And if it wasn't for some guidance that I got to rebuild myself, and to realize that you can do whatever you want to do. There's no excuse.
Right.
I came out here, the only money I had when I came to California was from selling my house, which is another story I found out because I had to learn a lot of stuff that I didn't even think about. I thought, I'm going to be really smart and I'm going to put 50 grand into a cashier's check. And then I'll just open up an account when I get to California. And then I find out, the IRS comes and looks at you once you deposit that much money here in California. And I'm like a deer in the headlights. I'm going like, what?
This is my money.
This is my money. And the IRS put a freeze on it. And if it wasn't for a really nice guy I met in L.A., I think he was with the FBI. They freed up my money because I told him, I said, I've got no way to pay my rent. I got no way to do anything. You have all my money.
So times ahead of us. How about, we have a lot of hurting veterans. And
yes, I
think that some of the things you've done might allow them to express that pain. The writing. I know we didn't even really talk about your poetry. This creative side, I think, is really a good place for these veterans to express their pain, I think.
Exactly. There's a number of creative outlets here, especially in Southern California. In North County, San Diego, there's a couple groups down there. One, I think, is by Vista, where if you're a vet, you can go in there and learn how to do artwork, and I don't believe they charge you.
No, they didn't.
I've seen some of the work they did, and it's beautiful. And these vets that go in there, it's like they're free.
Yeah.
And when I got into writing, the other thing is I joined a group called it was a veterans writing course, and originally was started to help vets with PTSD and get things out and get it onto paper, and then they would also teach you how to put your story into books and that's where I actually started out at first, and I eventually went up and ended up running it. But as it is, we ran out of money and it ended. But it was a great program for going around. We would go around to different areas and hold classes for veterans to come in and let them know, yeah, you could get it out on paper, write it down. You might not be a bestseller, but you're helping yourself, and it's a learning process. You keep growing, you get better, and you get better. Veterans in media and entertainment's another one. We bring in vets and teach them all about entertainment, acting. You could take all different types of courses at the through us, and it doesn't mean acting. You can work on set. You can be a grip. You could be a production assistant. The Shakespeare Theater in West LA, the sets are completely built by veterans. There's a lot of things in the arts and entertainment to help people. We just have to get out there and let them know about it and let them be part of it. And once you do that, you channel that depression or whatever into something creative. I think it's magical.
Yeah, it is. A lot of these veterans really truly have a story to tell too.
Most
people, and I'm not trying to downplay combat. I definitely am not, but most people lead pretty boring lives. Probably why war movies are so popular. And these vets should need to be telling these stories and it helps. I believe it will also help a lot of people understand the kind of struggles our veterans go through and have.
A lot of the better, I think, if you want to talk about war movies that come out, are the ones that are actually written by veterans.
Yeah.
And they have the involvement. One interesting point I'm going to bring up and how this helps. In Life After Oblivion, the lead actor, Ryan, a Marine Corps vet, combat vet, he's an actor, been an actor for a little while in Hollywood. He did this. And he called me up the day after we had wrapped, and it was going to go into a post-production. And he called me up and he says, I want to thank you for saving my life.
Really?
And I said, what are you talking about? And he said that by playing this character, I saw myself in it and realized I needed help. So I made the decision to quit drinking, and I went to a church, an all-night church that night that we wrapped in LA, and recommitted myself.
Well, that is good. That is magnificent.
And I said, that's probably the most humbling thing I've ever heard for myself. That's, it means a lot to know that you touched somebody who was actually in the film to recognize that. And I know this is now, we filmed this oh my God, when did we film this? In the first part of 2020, he hasn't drank or anything since.
That's great.
So it's, I know we changed one life.
Hey,
so
brother, yes, thank you. And what's your, I don't know what, that, no, that I'm like choked up. I mean, is, okay. What's on the future? What do you got going next?
Well, I've got a couple of negotiations going on right now for a television show. So, and I'm under an NDA, so I can't talk about it.
Okay.
But that looks good. It's looking good in that respect. So I'm gonna wait and see how that plays out. I just totally surprised me when they got a hold of me. And, he said I had that look.
No, you're okay. Hey, and fine, Tommy, let me just say, tell you what, let me do this. We're going to give you a round of applause. Okay. I used to not do that, but I do it now since a couple vets I know liked it. But look, Tommy, I really want to thank you for coming on. You're really, you know, we've never met in person, but you're a personal hero of mine because I see everything you do, because I know you're always working tirelessly for our veterans. And for people listening, please listen to The Real Tommy Unleashed. How can they find it, Tommy? On Spotify?
It's on the IQ Podcast Network. It's through their studios.
Okay.
Attorney King Studios in Coronado. It's on their Facebook page, we're on YouTube, Spotify, iHeartRadio.
Good.
Google something. There are more streaming places than I know.
And buy this man's books, Hey Boob Wind and 2 Million Steps. And also,
we just did another one that came out in May. It's called A Veteran Story. It's an anthology, which there's 29 of us veterans wrote it and won a Gold Star Wife. And it's basically our journey through the military up until today. And so it's very, very interesting. It's through MilVets Foundation out of Menifee. It's already a bestseller. It's a great read.
Say that one more time. A soldier's story or a veteran's story?
It's a veteran's story.
Veteran's story. Okay.
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's on any of the bookstores, online bookstores, you can get it. And it all goes to help support veterans who are in deployment with care packages, their families at home. It's a great organization.
Well, Tommy, thank you very much for coming on. Just for people listening, if you got any comments on how I can do this better, please leave them. Send them to me in my email address is in the show notes. I'll also, Tommy, if it's okay with you, leave your contact information, just an email. And let me tell people to please listen in next week, and God bless. And with that, I'm going to close it. And Tommy, I'll give you a call in a few minutes just to give you my personal thanks.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mark. Thank you so much for this opportunity. And thank you to your listeners.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.